Hello, and welcome to the 404 Media Podcast, where we bring you unparalleled access to hidden worlds, both online and IRL. 404 Media is a journalist-founded company and needs your support. To subscribe, go to 404media.co. As well as other bonus content, subscribers can hear us answer their questions in future podcasts. Ask us anything you want on podcasts at 404media.co. I'm your host, Joseph, and with me are 404 Media co-founders Sam Cole.
Hi.
Jason Kebler.
Hello, hello.
And finally back, Emmanuel Mayberg. How are you doing, Emmanuel?
I'm good. It's good to be back.
For those who didn't know, Emmanuel's been away on parental leave. We missed him very, very much. But he's back now, getting into the swing of things. Anything you want to flag that you're going to be looking into at all, Emmanuel, or is it more catching up? What's the vibe?
The diapers.
AI diapers.
Now. Baby surveillance cameras. What else?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of like anything original to say about being a new parent, and I don't have anything really other than like, you know, I wish I had a bit more sleep and stuff like that. The one thing I will say, and maybe I will write about it at some point, is I was immediately sucked into like parenting internet. And that has been kind of interesting and scary.
Like so social maybe, networks or sites or what? Without revealing too much if you're going to write about it.
Mostly social network stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't talk about it. You get tapped on the shoulder at the hospital and they hand you a notepad of a bunch of links.
Yeah.
When you have a child and they're like, don't share these.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're like, here, watch all this stuff if you want to feel like you're a terrible parent. And then they send you off.
But you're absolutely not a terrible parent. I can assure you that. But yeah, we're super glad to have you back. And I'm really excited to see what you're going to do and what we're all going to cover together. As for where we are now, there's just been some pretty interesting developments in an area that Jason covers, that is right to repair. Couple of stories here. First about Google changing its policy, and then an interview that Jason just carried out with a senior Google person in charge, sort of this thing. The first headline, Google formally endorses right to repair, will lobby to pass repair laws. Jason, what exactly do you mean that Google has formally endorsed right to repair? Like, what did Google do here?
Yeah, so last week, Google published a white paper where it says, here are our like principles on right to repair. And they're essentially saying, like, we believe that independent repair should be cheap, accessible, and easy, which is, you know, we've talked about it before on the show, but just basically the idea that if your phone breaks or your toaster breaks or your tractor breaks or your train breaks, you should be able to get repair guides and parts and like the software needed to do this. And this is like I talk about it a lot, but I've been covering right to repair for 9 years. I basically broke my MacBook back in 2015, right? And to get it fixed was going to cost like $1,000, and was able to do it with like a $50 part I bought on eBay and, you know, an iFixit guide. And ever since then, I've just like dove into this world. And for the first few years I was reporting on it, it was like, things are getting worse, things are getting worse, things are getting worse. But we saw these like, you know, additional barriers to repair happening. And they're still happening. Like, there's still a lot of companies that are like making it very difficult to repair Internet of Things devices, so on and so forth. But over the last like 2 years, it's been pretty much like unmitigated good news across the board. We had like the Biden administration come out and say, like, we support right to repair. We saw the FTC come out with some policy papers and saying, like, you know, we think repair should be possible. And then we've seen states start to consider and then ultimately pass legislation that would enshrine right to repair. So last year, New York, Minnesota, and California all passed right to repair laws. And I think the biggest thing, at least for me, covering this for a long time, is that Apple endorsed a right to repair bill in California,
right,
which is its home state. And then that bill passed unanimously. And this is after years of lobbying against these sorts of laws wherever they've been brought up. And I think that the Right to Repair movement had this strategy of like, if we can get 20 states to introduce this legislation every year, or 30 states or 40 states, then the big tech lobbyists have to like fight in each of these states. And even though it, you know, even though they have like more money and time than any other entities on planet Earth, it's like they're going to get sick of fighting this same battle in a bunch of different states, especially because it's very popular with people, like constituents, and it's really like a grassroots effort to get this stuff passed. So what happened was like Apple was spending millions of dollars fighting this. Mm-hmm. You had like these big tech lobbying groups like the Consumer Technology Association, which puts on CES and represents like thousands of companies, lobbying against it like all over. And eventually the big tech companies like, well, Apple, Google, even Microsoft to some extent, started making like repair parts more accessible. And then Apple endorsed this bill in California, and now Google has endorsed this bill in Oregon. And this is a pretty big deal.
Yes, absolutely. It's a big deal. You say that Google endorsed this looming legislation and it published a white paper. I guess to narrow it down even more, what exactly does that mean that Google's position is? Like, what is Google's position now on Right to Repair according to this? Do they just love it, or like, what's the position?
Yeah,
exactly?
Basically what it means is that like when Oregon has hearings about this stuff, like they're going to show up, and rather than having a lobbyist talk against the bill, they're going to speak in favor of the bill and say, you should pass this bill.
Which is wild. Really, really crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it is kind of like, it shows kind of how America works, because to some extent, it's like the opposition from companies like Google and Apple were why it took so long for these laws to get passed, because you have like these well-funded lobbyists who show up. They work like backroom deals with, you know, legislators saying like, vote against this or don't bring it to the floor or blah, blah, blah. Like, it will impact, you know, small businesses. We're going to pull out investment from the state, so on and so forth. Like, it's a mixture of like threats and fear-mongering, essentially. Mm-hmm. when companies lobby against something. But then when they're like, okay, we're good with this, that gives all of the like lawmakers permission to go vote for it, because a lot of them get donations from big companies like this. Like, it's pretty fucked up, but like, essentially Google is, in my opinion, ensuring that a bill will pass in Oregon, and it's the strongest bill that exists so far. And I know I still haven't quite answered your question, but their policy is basically like, we're going to make repair parts available for Pixel phones, for Chromebooks, for all the stuff that we make, and we think that every manufacturer should be required by law to do this for the things that they make as well.
Yeah, and they think that it shouldn't just be Google that's allowed to repair things. We will sell these parts, and then an independent repair shop will be able to just use those and fix it however they see fit, right?
Yeah, and the big difference in Oregon, and the reason that this is exciting or different from California or Minnesota or New York, which all passed laws, is it's an even more strict bill than those other three states. And that's because Google is specifically saying that parts pairing should be illegal. And parts pairing is where basically you need like the manufacturer to unlock a device in order for a repair part to work. So it's like, if the phone screen breaks and you take a screen from another phone and put it on the old one, like the one that you're trying to fix, it won't work until, like, if it's an iPhone, it won't work unless you take it to an Apple store and they put it through essentially like a calibration machine and say that this part is now approved to work with this phone. And that's like an arbitrary software lock that is super common across devices, where you need like the manufacturer permission to use a repair part. And that's how they've like monopolized repairs, because they say like only authorized places who pay us a fee or who have been trained by us or who are owned by us can right. actually do these repairs. And Google is saying that should not be legal. And the Oregon bill is saying that should not be legal. And so if that's passed, that would change That would change how Apple does business, for example. And I don't know. This
does not just apply to Google. That's of course, because it's going to be a law, right? It's not just going to apply to Google. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to change it overnight. It's like there may be specific carve outs and stuff like that. Like, you know, I'm always a little bit skeptical when these things happen, but so far it's like Google is essentially endorsing the strictest, like the most expansive right to repair bill that's ever been proposed, which is pretty big deal.
Yeah, totally. You then got to speak to Stephen Nickel, who is Google's Director of Consumer Hardware Operations. The headline is YouTube commenters and the grassroots movement pushed Google to support right to repair. Pretty self-explanatory, but the full interview is really interesting. I think people should go read it. But what did Stephen attribute to the change? I mean, of course, it's Google making this change, but they didn't just do this in a vacuum. Like, what did they say led up to it?
Yeah, so Google's been taking shit for years from people for, like, the Pixel was really hard to repair for a long time. It was, like, very easy to break wires or whatever. Like, when you opened it, it was very easy to physically damage it. So a few years ago, with one of the new Pixels, I think it was, like, the Pixel 4 or Pixel 5, they made it, like, a little bit easier to get into and to repair. And there were a few YouTubers who made teardown videos, and they specifically noted, like, oh, they made these design changes that made it easier to repair this stuff. And, you know, Stephen Nickel, this guy who's been working on repair at Google, told me that he saw the comments to that video and saying, like, oh my God, this is awesome. Like, this is really important to me. Repair is really important to me. And he said that for him, that was a light bulb moment where he was then able to go back to, like, the designers of, you know, all of the future iterations of the Pixel and say, like, we need to introduce new features that make this more repairable. And then ultimately he said that, you know, that conversation is what started Google on this path to, you know, throwing its policy weight behind it as well. And that's something that I've learned a lot over the last, like, I would say year, as manufacturers have started talking more about right to repair and saying, like, we understand this actually is important. Is, I mean, Google is one of the largest companies on the planet. And within the company, there are people who are like, we actually agree with the idea that the phone should be repairable, but they work on such timescales that it's like, it's not like a 12-month problem where it's like, oh, we're going to completely redesign our phone. We're going to completely redesign our software. We're going to completely redesign our policies and, like, push it all out because we're getting shit on by, like, all of these repair nerds, frankly. And, like, Jason's writing mean articles about us. It's like they might agree with what we're saying, or, like, there may be teams within Google that agree with the criticisms that they're taking. But in order to, like, get that out to the public, it takes like 5, 6, 7 years.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's a massive bureaucracy. It's not a startup anymore, obviously. It's a massive machine that takes a long time to get anything changed, it seems.
Yeah, and I mean, that doesn't mean that Google doesn't deserve the criticism, and I think that they do deserve the criticism, like, over the course of years. But I think it's like we talk so much about how bad companies are and how they've had, like, a negative effect on, you know, open source, on AI, like how they're shoving a bunch of things down our throats that are anti-consumer, so on and so forth. And I think that that remains the case, but I also think that this is an example of where, like, a grassroots movement and a bunch of angry consumers and YouTube commenters and, like, YouTubers doing teardowns and, like, all of this stuff were able to, one, put pressure on the politicians who were then able to, like, change their mind on policy, but also to put pressure on a company like Google that, you know, could have continued ignoring everyone forever. But this is an example of, like, small progress. And I think it's good to highlight that, because very often we talk about how things are bad, and it's sometimes good to talk about how, you know, there
years
can
later
be positive change. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I guess just the last thing is, Is there a catch? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you mentioned in the interview with Stephen Nichols, you bring up like, oh, the, you know, the changes with Apple, but it felt like there was something of a catch. Is there a similar catch here, or do we not know yet? Or
yeah, I mean, there might be, is my answer. I think it's like when I asked, you know, Stephen, like, what's the catch here? He was like, there's no real catch. Like, we actually do support this. I think that you could be cynical and look at it and be like, well, Google was going to have to comply with some version of this in California, which is, you know, obviously the most populous state. So
right.
Usually when companies comply with something in California, they comply with it everywhere. So they're like, well, they're going to have to do this anyway. They can get some positive PR by supporting this in Oregon and elsewhere. And then I think the other criticism you could make is like, what they're supporting is good for Google, bad for Apple. So it's, you know, a competitor. And then it's also good for maybe like a very well-established, well-resourced company that can comply with these laws like relatively easily. Like they can make, you know, a million and pixel screens and stock them at various places and make it easy for customers to get it. Whereas like a startup company might have a harder time like distributing parts and like figuring out how to comply with the law and so on and so forth. So it may be a little bit more difficult for like smaller companies to comply with these sorts of laws, depending on how they're implemented. And then, I mean, who knows? It's like they could erode the specifics of the law like around the edges at some point, but because we haven't seen like what the past legislation, ultimately what's going to be enacted in Oregon isn't right. final yet, like we're not completely sure. So I would say I'm like cautiously optimistic, but yeah, there are like small catches here, but I think overall it's like a good thing.
Yeah,
not a catch, but I was gonna ask, for Google to support this seems somewhat easier than for Apple to support something like this, especially the parts pairing, because they're both gigantic technology companies. But Google, as far as I understand, is not nearly as big in the hardware selling business, in the consumer electronics business. They have a ton of products. They've been around for many years, but it's nothing like what Apple is.
Yeah, I mean, the Pixel, I believe, was like one of Google's first pieces of hardware. And that was only, I think, like 7 or 8 years ago. So, I mean, Google says this all the time, that they're new to the hardware industry, that they're a newcomer. I mean, I think it's, take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, you can't say that now.
Huge. Yeah, but I think that you're absolutely right. And then the other thing is that, you know, Google has much less control over the Android ecosystem. And I think it is actually good if Google, as the manufacturer of an OS, sort of supports legislation that, you know, Samsung is going to have to comply with, Motorola is going to have to comply with, like all of the manufacturers selling Android phones are going to have to comply with this as well. And so I think like as a software provider, it almost makes more sense for Google to say like, hey, we support this, versus like as a hardware supplier. Like I do think that it's good for their consumers, and their consumers aren't always using Google hardware. They're often using someone else's hardware, but then using Google software.
Yeah, totally. All right, we'll see what comes out of Oregon and whether there really are no catches. We'll have to check when the text and more information comes out. We'll leave that there. But after the break, we're going to talk about a pretty unusual court case, which brings up all sorts of questions about online dating, but also safety, and I guess there's a free speech element in there as well. Sam wrote that story. We will be right back after this. And we are back. All right, as mentioned, Sam wrote this story. Man sues 27 women after Facebook users call him, quote, clingy and, quote, psycho. Kind of a lot to unpack here, Sam, actually. So who and what is this man suing? Because it's not just these 27 women. I'm actually going to bring up the article as well. But who else is he suing?
Yeah, he's suing everybody.
Everybody.
Oh my God. Like, I mean, my not clinging and psycho shirt is bringing up a lot of questions answered by my not clinging and psycho shirt. So he is suing, it's a guy in Chicago or like in the Chicago area, or he's suing in the Chicago area named Nico D'Ambrosio. He's suing 27 women, one of which, said she went on a date with him once, one man, 20 different LLCs that are associated with Facebook, Meta in general, Patreon, GoFundMe, and a website called arewedatingthesame.com. Yeah, he's suing everybody. He's claiming damages that women on the associated with these groups on Facebook called Are We Dating the Same Guy talked about negative experiences, negative encounters that they had with him in the groups, and that it caused all kinds of damages in his life,
right?
Which we can get into.
Yeah, he's. Yeah. I presume he's seeking like the normal damages, all the sorts of stuff, the normal stuff that would come up in a lawsuit:
defamation, emotional distress, invasion of privacy, doxing.
Right. And we don't know anything beyond what's in the lawsuit, right? We're just reporting basically the allegations that are in the court document. But for those who don't know, there's a little bit of a broader context here on. What are these Facebook groups of Are We Dating the Same Guy? Like, how did they start and sort of how did they spread out?
Yeah, so these groups, I think the first one was in 2022. These groups started as a way for people to, especially women, because the original ones were called Are We Dating the Same Guy? So it was like targeted toward straight women, dating men, and you know, there are different groups for every major city. But in the groups, you could go in, you could post someone's name or a picture or like a screenshot of someone's dating profile or whatever, and then say, does anybody have any tea or red flags? It's kind of the parlance of the groups. And then other people can say, because you're in a, you're local in a city. The first one started in New York. You could say, oh yeah, that guy, I went on a date with him and this happened. Like he was, you know, violent or dangerous or lame or whatever. It's like, you can kind of just say whatever your experience was about that date, that guy, if you know him.
Yeah. Right. It's a lot of it is a safety thing, right? Yeah. Because of course, when you're going on an online date, you don't necessarily know who exactly it is that you're going on a date with. It's sort of the logical next step after trying to Google somebody, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I mean, you want to kind of, I mean, like online dating, especially for women, is really, it can be really dangerous. Like just meeting someone randomly from the internet in general is usually a little bit of a risk, even in these days when everyone's Googleable. But the instances of violence on dates is pretty high. So it makes sense that these groups would be filling that need, that they say, you know, we're not here to like, and there's lots of rules that you have to agree to as part of these groups, you know, saying you're not going to come in and just make stuff up or be needlessly judgmental or just don't be shitty to the guys. Like just tell the truth, or tell what your experience was, not even the truth. It's filling that kind of, it's almost like a harm reduction need. But when you are doing that in this kind of rogue way with not a lot of, I guess there are mods, but you know, they don't know what's true and what's not.
Right. It is somebody groups. Joining a group. Yeah. And then saying this happened and, that may or may not be the case. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. You could just go in there and make stuff up. There's no one stopping you.
Which I presume is what this guy is alleging, right? But when it comes to how big they've gotten, I mean, some of the figures in here are, what, 3.5 million members now with 600 moderators? Is that across the entire US? Like, what is that exactly?
I'm pretty sure that's across the US. And then there's also a standalone website that's the are we dating the same.com, which is part of the lawsuit, where it's almost like a database. Like you can just kind of like plug in someone's name, search to see if anybody has ever made an entry about them, and it's all in that one place. So instead of joining a bunch of Facebook groups and like across lots of different cities, you can just be on that website. It's big. It's really, I mean, it was only started in 2022, which is not that long ago. And I was like, surely this has been around forever. And it really hasn't been around that long.
Right. And there's already millions and millions of people using it. What is he alleging exactly?
Yeah, he's, the complaint is in the article on the site. So you can kind of go through and look if you're curious what the actual the screenshots were that were included in the complaint. But he's alleging that I think the wording of the complaint, which we should probably stick to, considering this guy seems litigious.
I have the graph here actually. I just brought it up. I think this is from the complaint itself, and I think this summarizes the position pretty fairly. It says the defendants, as in the women and Facebook and everybody else that's suing, the defendants broadcast their outrageous, cruel, and malicious lies about the plaintiff with knowledge that the statements were false or with reckless disregard as whether or not they were true. End of quote. We, again, don't have any insight into that of whether that's the case or not, but I still think it's interesting in that these groups and this site are becoming mega popular, and this sort of lawsuit, almost regardless of the merits of this particular one, is probably a sign of things to come, right? Would you agree with that?
I mean, I think it's going to be interesting how this plays out in court. I know that the law firm that's representing him is trying to find more people to come forward about similar experiences. I've had lots of people come to me who have been on both sides of this. Like, you know, they're users of the groups, and then they're also people who've been posted who feel wronged. But I mean, just like from my own like armchair guessing of how this is going to go, it's really broad. And I think that's probably on purpose. Like they're starting very broad and they're probably going to be forced to narrow this down. But I can't see. I mean, it would be very bad if you could sue Facebook or Patreon or any of these platforms for what people say on them, because that's the point of Section 230.
Right, it's not going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen. And if it does, if they find some kind of loophole through the process of doing this, that bodes really poorly for the way people can use these platforms. Even if you don't like the way they're using it, you know, it could set a precedent that could be really scary. And I mean, Section 230 has been under lots of different scrutiny, and, you know, it's very controversial. Some people are very pro, especially people who are into free speech rights, very pro Section 230. Lots of different victim advocates, and I assume these guys are against these platforms. And just to be clear, that part of the law is it makes platforms not liable for what people say and do on them. So you can say libelous defamatory things on Facebook, and Facebook isn't going to get sued for it.
Yeah, I think that defamation is a very specific thing, and you can't win a defamation suit just because someone said something that you don't like. Yeah. It's like there's a very specific legal term for it, or like legal definition, and it depends on whether you're a public figure or a private figure. I think that in this case, we can probably safely assume that this person is a private figure because he's just like a random in Chicago. But if what the people are saying about you is true, you can't be defamed. Like you're not going to win a defamation suit. And in this case, from what we have seen, like I can only talk about what we've seen in the court documents, but it's like he's not denying that he had a sexual relationship with the person who originally posted about him. That person is entitled to their own opinions, and their own opinion was not like this person did violence to me or something that can be disproven. It was that they thought he was clingy and they thought that he was a psycho. And those are like statements of opinion that are like generally not, like you can generally say that, especially if that's how you felt. And especially if, you know, she's posting screenshots of their text exchanges. It's like, I don't know how this is ultimately going to shake out. And it's kind of, you know, anytime there's like a defamation case, it's kind of scary because, you know, there's like a lot of ways that these things can go sideways if they get to discovery. Not only the messages with, you know, him would come out, but any messages that she sent to anyone else about him, so on and so forth, like would come out. And like that process alone is very, can be very scary. But having just like read this complaint, it was very notable to me that they did not include the entire thread of what was said about him. It's like they had like a couple screenshots, but there was not a lot. And they also didn't really like allege specific like harms to him. They aren't saying like he lost out on his future wife because some woman wouldn't go on a date with him because they had read what was happening on here. So like you have to prove that it like impacted your life negatively in some way and not just, hey, I saw people saying mean things about me in a closed Facebook group.
Yeah, totally. I'm interested what this means for the broader context on social networks, what people can or can't say on them, and all of that sort of thing. I guess we'll keep an eye on the docket and see what else comes out of it. If you are listening to the free version of the podcast, I'll now play us out. But if you're a subscriber, we're going to talk about a data set we just published on the spread of AI-enabled cameras across the country. It's an interactive map. We can download the Google Sheet and you can check if you know, your local police department has bought access to that system. You can subscribe and gain access to that content at 404media.co. As a reminder, 404 Media is journalist founded and supported by subscribers. If you wish to subscribe to 404 Media and directly support our work, please go to 404media.co. You'll get unlimited access to our articles and ad-free version of this podcast. You'll also get to listen to the subscribers-only section where we talk about a bonus story each week. Another way to support us is by leaving a 5-star rating and review for the podcast. That stuff really helps us out. This has been 404 Media. We will see you again next week.